Morning.
That Bible almost needs its own postcode. Well, it's great to be here this morning, and it's great to look again at God's Word in Ephesians to see what it has to say to us today about work. Now, I'd like to ask a few questions just to get us thinking about this topic, about work. First thing I'd like us to think, you know, who do you work for? I wonder, you might work for a big multinational company. Perhaps you're self-employed. Perhaps you work for a small family business or a small firm. You might be employed by the government. Perhaps you're a student, in which case, if you're receiving fee help, you're employed by the government to study. Perhaps you're a full-time mum. Some of us here might even be retired. Think about the bosses you've had or you have now. What have your bosses been like? Good, bad, encouraging, threatening, lazy, moody, a wide range of bosses. What about the sort of work that you do? Are you engaged in blue-collar work, manual labour, or white-collar work? You might be in sales or marketing. You might be a banker. You might be a teacher. Might be an engineer. And there's one question that, as I've been reading this passage, has kept coming up in my mind, and I'm pretty sure it might have occurred to some of us at some stage too. That question is, what good is work? You know, no matter who I work for or what sort of work I do, what good is work? When we read Ecclesiastes, we see that all work done under the sun is mist and vapour. It just passes. And I'm sure most of us have asked this question. We ask questions like, is work just a means to an end? Is there only short-term value, or is there any eternal significance to the work that I'm doing? Is there any eternal significance to produce this financial report for Monday morning? What's the eternal significance of finishing off this building project in time and busting my chops to get it done? And what will this software that I've designed say in eternity when it's going to be replaced in 3 years by something that's outdated it already? Is there a point in working hard when no one seems to notice or appreciate my efforts? These sorts of questions play around in our heads. What good is work? Now, for many of us, work can just be a horrible necessity. Well, not even a horrible, but a begrudging necessity of life. You know, we have perhaps a mortgage, we have maybe mouths to feed. Work is just a means to an end, it's a necessity. We go through the daily grind, day after day, we sleep, we eat, we work, we eat, we sleep, and we start all over again when the sun rises. Some of us find security in our work. There might be an identity, it gives us meaning. People can appreciate our abilities in the way that we work and in the job that we do. Some of us have a sense of power or authority. We might have people working underneath us, and we feel a sense of authority from our work. And here we read some instructions of Paul about work, written to the slaves in Ephesus in the first century. Well, I wonder what they thought about what good is their work. Maybe they thought that they're working tirelessly and they never see any reward. They work day after day to line someone else's pockets. Perhaps they're thinking that when they die, they're going to have nothing to show for all their toil. I'm sure the slaves were asking, what good is work? Well, so far in Ephesians, we've seen that when the Ephesians believed in the gospel of Jesus, that they radically changed their lifestyle. And what was so radical about this change of lifestyle is that it doesn't just affect some facets of life, but it affects all facets of life. Every aspect of our life is changed by the radical lifestyle from faith in Jesus. And Paul is writing here to remind the Ephesians that this radical lifestyle must affect the way they relate to each other as slaves and masters. This is the third in what was called a household table, as Brian mentioned last week. The third area of life that affects general life in the household. So first, we saw that wives must submit and husbands must sacrifice. Second, we saw the relationship between children and parents. Children are to obey their parents, and parents are not to be too hard on their kids, but to teach them Christ. And then thirdly, because most households would have had slaves, we come to the relationship between slaves and masters. So what does this have to do with us? These are first century slaves, and we're 21st century freed men and women, where slavery doesn't exist. Well, because this was the normal part of life for a huge percentage of people in the first century, slavery, in essence, was work to them. Someone could either be born into slavery, or perhaps if someone went into debt, they could sell themselves as a slave to clear their debt, and it would still allow them an opportunity to eat and to be clothed and to have somewhere to live and sleep. It wasn't ideal, obviously, and it would have been a hard life. But there is evidence to suggest that the majority of slaves would have been reasonably well looked after, if only for the self-interest of the owner who's made the investment. There was also harsh treatment of slaves, quite common, and we'll come back to that a little bit later. But we see here in this society that the slave owners were in authority over their slaves. Now, slaves' skills and professions could have ranged greatly. Some slaves would have been doctors. We have records to show. Some slaves would have just been working around the household, washing dishes, preparing the meals. Some slaves, in effect, actually acted like a CEO over the master's, businesses and affairs. And the principles we see here in this passage for slaves and masters actually apply directly to modern employees and employers. So let's have a look together at Ephesians. We'll start at verse 5, where slaves are told to obey your earthly masters with respect and fear and with sincerity of heart, just as you would obey Christ. We're told the slaves are told to work as unto the Lord. So they are to work as if they're working for the Lord. So this is quite a shocking statement, this verse, really, to us, because I think we expect Paul to come out swinging at the institution of slavery. Why doesn't Paul fight slavery here? Why is he reinforcing this oppressive kind of structure? And then he commands the slaves to obey with respect and fear. Well, when we look at it in context, we actually see that this is quite a similar instruction to the earlier instructions with wives and husbands, the distinction between wives and husbands, and the distinction between children and parents, where we see that these distinctions, these different roles, are necessary in order that family and society can function properly. Here also, the relationship between the slave and the master must be retained. But there's more here that Paul says. Paul's not just making this command in order to have some sort of social stability. If we look at verse 6, we see that this is actually doing the will of God. Paul teaches that slaves should obey and serve their masters as they would Christ himself, for this is the will of God. Serve as they would Christ. Notice that's really strong language. That's a really strong instruction. But the language used here is quite similar to what Paul has been using earlier. In chapter 5, verse 22, we see that wives are to submit to their husbands as to the Lord. In verse 23 of chapter 5, the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ is the head of the church. And in chapter 6, verse 1, we see that children are to obey their parents in the Lord. So here, carrying on this theme, in chapter 6, verse 5 to 9, slaves are taught to submit to their master as unto the Lord. Did you notice that in all of these three relationships described, the relationship and the submission in the relationship is tied up in relationship with Christ? Every relationship that we have here on earth is to be seen in light of our relationship to God. And authority that we are under is to be seen as authority that God has placed us under. And really, this comes back to the heading of this whole section. Look with me at chapter 5, verse 21. The heading before this section begins says, "Submit to one another out of reverence for Christ." It is the will of God that we submit out of reverence to Christ. So what does this actually look like? Verse 7 says we are to serve wholeheartedly. And chapter 5, verse 5 says, with respect and fear and sincerity. Sincerity and wholeheartedly. This is working hard. This is working honestly. It's not being lazy. It's not producing inferior work. It's not working to less than our best standard. There's no sort of she'll be right, near enough's good enough, that'll do kind of attitude here, is there? Because we know that near enough's not good enough for Christ. We see here that we need to produce wholehearted, sincere, top quality work. We need to faithfully use our time for what we're being either paid or unpaid, for what is our occupation in life. I want you to imagine that a large multinational company approached you to come and be CEO, and they offered you a brilliant pay package of $30,000 a year. Now, to me, that actually does sound brilliant at the moment, but that's another story. How hard do you think you would be inclined to work? You're being paid by a multi-million dollar company, a measly $30,000, really, to do a CEO's job, which is an intense job. Now, what if they offered you $180,000? You know, I think you'd be inclined to work a bit harder, to put in a bit more of, you know, a bit more of your time thinking and working through the issues of the company. But if they were going to pay you $3.5 million a year, I think you'd be pretty crazy not to be putting in 100%. Now, this just demonstrates that it's easier for us to work when there's a greater reward. But what if you weren't being paid for your efforts? What if all of your efforts went unrewarded and simply lined someone else's pockets? Do you think you'd have much motivation then? It'd be pretty hard, wouldn't it? I actually, when I used to have a landscaping business, anyone who knows me really well knows that I'm a tragic optimist, and I always think things are going to take less time than they do and be cheaper than they are, and I'm absolutely terrible at quoting. It actually almost ran me bankrupt a few times, but I'd always underquote myself. And when a job gets to the point where you realise that, you know, your standard hourly rate that you should be making, when you realise that you're not actually making that anymore, your feet start to get heavy, your shoulders sag. You're tempted to cut corners. You're tempted to just, you know, do whatever it takes to try and get this over and done with as quickly as possible. But then, when you realise that you're actually paying to do the job you're doing, which has happened to me, unfortunately, when you realise you're not making anything, there's no reward, all you want to do is put down your tools and go home. Can you imagine what it must have been like for these slaves? Paul tells them to obey with respect and fear, with sincerity of heart, to serve wholeheartedly when there's no reward for them. And so if these slaves in Ephesus can work like this, if they can submit like this, how much more can we? So we should work as if we are working for God in respect and fear, knowing that a half-baked effort is not good enough for God, but we need to put in 100%. Now, I want to caveat that as an aside, that we need to remember that, fortunately for us, unlike slaves, we have boundaries with work. And it's important to note that this comes at the end of the relationships in the family, that our relationships with our family come first. And we need to be careful not to equate putting in 100% effort with working endless hours of overtime eating into our family life, because we know that that's not right. I think often, though, we will find if we change our work ethic and our attitude towards work, we probably realise that in the time we spend in our office, we're not completely being productive 100% of the time. So when we obey those in authority over us, we see here that we're actually obeying the will of God. Anyone here who is retired, I want to encourage you that there is something here for you. That those of us who aren't working need to encourage others the importance of doing God's will in this way. And we come to verse 6. We need to forget about pleasing man and we need to please God. Forget about pleasing man and please God. Let's read verse 6. Obey them not only to win their favour when their eye is on you, but like slaves of Christ doing the will of God from your heart. Now this is a call to integrity, isn't it? Often we can be so good at keeping up appearances. When the boss is watching, when we know that the boss is watching, you know, we're going to make sure that we're seen to be doing the right thing, that we're working hard. But when there's no one looking, it's easy to slack off, to find something else, to be less than productive. Now, I think some of us were reminded of this recently, when several months ago, an interview on Channel 7, I believe it was Chris Barth, was interviewing someone from Macquarie Bank. I hear laughing, someone remembers what this is. And in the background was some of the workstations of Macquarie Bank. And there was one bloke who was facing away from the camera, didn't realise the camera was on, but we can see his computer screen. So during this interview, you can see flashing on his computer screen are pictures of bikini women. And he gets to the end and someone sends him an email and he realises the email says turn around, and he turns around and realises that the whole time he's been messing around when he should have been working, he's actually been caught red-handed. Now, it's funny, but I think we can feel a slight bit of empathy for him, because we know that we, if we were watched 100% of the time, we too would have plenty of times where we are working at less than our capacity. There's so many opportunities for us. I mean, we've got Twitter, we've got YouTube, Facebook, Google. We can waste hours doing things. We can get distracted with chatting around the water cooler. There's so many ways we can waste time at work, making personal calls during work hours, just working slowly and lazily, coming up with excuses for why the task is taking so long. We can take longer lunch breaks than we're supposed to. You know, sneak an extra 10 minutes in every day. But that's not what we're being paid to do. We need to remember that it is God we need to please, and not just to keep our bosses off our backs. But it's God we need to please, and He sees all. We're not simply to appear to be doing what's right, but we are to do what is right. Now, also, another slight caveat is that we must submit to those in authority over us when it's appropriate to do so. In the same way that children are to submit to their parents when it's appropriate to do so, that is always, apart from times when there is something expected of them that is immoral. And in the same way for us, perhaps at work it's the pressure to lie, the pressure to take credit for something that we haven't done, the pressure to perhaps to fudge some numbers on the tax return, perhaps to make things look better than they are to a client when really things aren't going so well. There might be pressure if you drive for work. I know that a lot of people in the transport industry feel a constant pressure to be making faster delivery times and to break the road rules. Any time we're expected to do something immoral, we are not to submit in that way. Because when we think about it, it goes the other way. It's God that we're supposed to please and not man. So we need to work with consistency and integrity, and please God, not man. Now the crux of this passage, the real eye-opener here is in verse 8. It's that God sees and that God judges. God sees and He judges. So as Paul is turning from talking to the slaves to speak to the slave owners, he says something quite remarkable. Let's read it. We know that the Lord will reward everyone for whatever good he does, whether he is slave or free. So far there's been a distinction between slaves and masters, and Paul has addressed only the slaves, if you like, the lower of the two, the lesser class. But here, Paul boldly states that on the day that God judges, there is no lesser class. There will be no distinction between slave or free. And that God, who sees in full, will judge accordingly. And this agrees with the rest of Scripture. We cannot earn our salvation, but when we're forgiven for our sin, when we trust in Christ, and that we will be judged according to how we live. Now, if you think about it, this would have actually been a tremendous encouragement to the Ephesian slaves. Many of them would have been treated unfairly. Many of them would have worked hard and never received the honour due to a human being. They wouldn't have received respect or thanks. But when they stand before God, alongside their earthly masters, they will be equal before him, and they will receive the reward that they missed out on. This would have been great news to the slaves. But more than that, not only will the slaves receive the reward they deserve, but the masters will be judged for any injustice done to the slaves. So it's on this note of the God who sees all and rewards good that Paul addresses the slave owners. Slave owners are taught, in verse 9, to treat the slaves with the same respect that the slaves are taught to show them. See verse 9. Treat your slaves in the same way. Well, what's the same way? It's the same way that Paul's been teaching the slaves to treat their masters. And if the slaves are taught to serve their masters as if they're serving Christ, then surely the master should treat his slaves as if it was Christ who was serving him. Now, I'm sure this would have changed the dynamic of many slave-master relationships. And this is reminiscent also of what we've read earlier, that the husband is not to be a tyrant over his wife, and that the father is not to exasperate his children. And here, the master is warned not to threaten his slaves. And the motivation given here for the master is quite clear, because the slave's heavenly master, God, is master over the slave's earthly master. So the slave's heavenly master is master over the slave's earthly master. And the slave's heavenly master will hold the earthly master accountable for his actions on the last day. So in the same way that the slave is to respect and fear their earthly master wholeheartedly and sincerely, the slave owner is to respect and fear the heavenly master wholeheartedly with sincerity. God sees the affliction of the poor and helpless, and he will not keep silent forever. And isn't this the great surprise of the gospel? That no longer is there slave or free, but all are slaves of Christ. Slaves to a perfect and loving master. These days, we do have quite good workplace relations laws that minimise injustice, but there is still a whole lot of threats, a whole lot of abuse, a whole lot of unfair treatment by people in authority over those working under them. Threats are a means of wielding power over someone in order to try and have some control over them or manipulation. I want to say to you that this passage says that if we are responsible for staff, we need to treat them with the respect they deserve. We can't be pushy and bullying or belittling people or threatening them, because we need to remember that God cares how we treat them and that God will judge us. Now, this doesn't mean that there can't be any penalties for poor work or disobedience, but there must be no power mongering over people. We need to lead with love, with respect. We need to be understanding. We need to listen to people. We need to treat them as equal human beings. Employers are not to bully or harass those under them, because their heavenly master is watching. God sees, God judges, God is master of all. Now, I want to encourage you with the fact that I struggle not to please men, and that often, as is common to men, my own struggle also is to remember to please God and not to please men. Well, that sort of brings us to the end of thinking about the value of work. What good is work? Is work just a means to an end? Is it something that holds only short-term value? Or is there eternal worth to what we do? Well, we see here that work does hold eternal significance when we submit as to the Lord, when we submit out of reverence to Christ, because then we're doing God's will. We see that work holds eternal significance when we please God, not man, when we're seeking to please our heavenly Master, not just please those around us. We see that work holds eternal significance when we relate to each other out of fear and respect for God. And that work holds eternal significance because God will reward us on the last day for the good that we do. So who am I working for? Who are you working for? If you're working for your heavenly Master, then your work is good. You'll be rewarded. But if all you're trying to do is keep your earthly masters, keep your boss off your back and scrape by, then your work is nothing more than just mist and vapor that will vanish. I hope that you can see that this radical lifestyle for work is far more significant and fulfilling than just trying to scrape by and get the boss off our back. As it's just one facet of radical lifestyle that's changed by the freedom and grace of the gospel, this lifestyle is quite radical. People will see, people will notice when we work this way, and we will bring glory to God.